wonderful story about Felix Mendelssohn, the conductor and composer, that he had a terrific musical memory, one of the best musical memories in the history of European musical arts. And every piece he ever conducted, he had essentially memorized, but it drove his audiences crazy if he didn't actually have a piece of music in front of him as he conducted. And so he would routinely set scores in front of himself and never turn the pages. He would just sort of have a score there to put people's minds at rest. That's essentially what I'm doing here. I apologize for the podium, but I'm a compulsive walker, and I do have a couple little scraps of notes in front of me that I'll be making use of now and then. I am Peter Mercer Taylor, and thank you all for foregoing ice cream, as I gather most of you have, in order to be here this evening to enjoy, as you know, to the extent that we're all able, the first of our five sessions this week dedicated to making Christian sense of popular music. This is a pretty tall order where this title is concerned. It invites many different kinds of sense-making processes, and in the course of this week, we're going to be trying various kinds of things. But one thing I wanted to do this evening was actually clarify just a bit some things that my biography out on the kiosk may not clarify. One of the first things I did when I arrived yesterday was to wander to the kiosk and try to kind of make sense of my week. And I stumbled across my own biography and realized it's very helpful if what you're trying to do is build a drum kit from household supplies, but not all that helpful if you're trying to figure out sort of who I am and what I'm doing here and what my stake in all this is. I am a practicing musicologist. I have a PhD in musicology, or as some people call it, music history and literature, which means that I am hired by my home institution, University of Minnesota, not to make music. I do play a certain amount of music and to enjoy making music and performing it when possible, but that is not what the school hired me to do. The school hires me to teach history courses about music, about the sort of history and criticism of music. Like most musicologists, I got into this business via classical music. Although I grew up making rock and roll music, playing the guitar, playing the bass guitar, singing for as many folks as would listen, that is not what I got into the business of musicology doing. I got into the musicology business as a Mendelssohn scholar, working on early 19th century German art music. And that still is where much of my attention goes, and that is how I'm probably best known in the musicological community. But the musicology business is at this interesting point in its history at which rock and rock-era popular song have become respectable in a new way, that this has turned out to be a viable subject of study, that all kinds of musicologists out there are exploring popular music of various kinds. And this has been an important kind of sidelight to the Mendelssohn work that I have done. And I have written on a range of artists that I just happen to like, that I just happen to find interesting, on R.E.M., on the folk singer Bill Staines, on the Bangles, one of my favorite bands from my own college days, and on, well, a range of Elvis Costello, a range of topics, sort of grabbing on the things that interest me. And I also have been teaching a lot of popular music. And when it comes to the teaching of popular music, there are many different things we can ask of popular music. We can ask about its styles, we can ask about its history, about the fashions that attend it, about the sociology, its sociological underpinnings. None of these things are really what I do. What interests me as a student of popular music is really the craft of songwriting in all of its refinement. What interests me is people who seem to be, for whatever reason, especially good at putting songs together, putting notes in just the right place, coming up with textures that are just the right textures, with sort of musical plots that are just the right kinds of musical plots, and frequently words that are just the right kinds of words to go along with those things. So as we make our way through tonight's conversation about a couple songs, maybe three songs, and as we make our way through the week, for those of you who choose to come to more of these, this is what you will realize quickly about my own personal way of doing things, is that I'm not actually that interested in history, and I'm not that interested in sort of stylistic matters writ large or sociological matters where this popular music is concerned. I'm interested in what makes those songs we're looking at this week great songs. And I think nearly all of them, perhaps all of them, are in some sense great songs. That is certainly true tonight. Tonight we are listening to nothing but the cream of the cream, some of the very best rock songs that have ever been committed to vinyl or to MP3 format, or however we get our pop music. I will not walk you through the rest of the week's offerings, but I do invite you to follow those kinds of moving targets through the week. The place will always be here, the times change, topics change, but you can check the boards if you want to come back for more. But if our goal is to make Christian sense of popular song, finally I would come to roost on the question of why begin where we're beginning. And to begin with, by making Christian sense of contemporary pop music, I don't mean that I'm going to be sort of ferreting my way through popular music to find those songs that actually are Christian, that talk about God, that talk about Jesus, whatever. Those songs can be found. U2 has recorded many of them. Some of the songs we'll be listening to do, in fact, have explicitly religious imagery or make explicitly religious affirmations. But the songs we're looking at this week all have in common the fact that they're basically secular songs, or come from artists who are best known for secular work, who are not thought of as Christian artists, not thought of as artists sort of deeply rooted in a tradition of communicating a certain kind of spiritual vantage point. Rather, this is essentially secular music that we'll be looking at, but secular music to which I want to suggest a Christian can bring a kind of negotiated perspective. These are songs, all of the songs we'll be listening to this week, are songs that seem to have something to tell us about how the Christian looks at the world, or songs that seem to be able to nourish in some way the Christian way of looking at the world, the Christian way of asking questions of the world around us, of the meaning of faith, of the meaning of hope, of the meaning of despair, of how we are to navigate these various things. And in many cases, these are songs that navigate these human experiences in overtly secular ways, ways that have nothing to do with Christianity. But at many times, those ways that these songs have of foregrounding these matters, hope, despair, life's meanings, and so on, pop music's ways of foregrounding those things can still be extremely helpful, I think, within a Christian worldview, and finally can be nourishing of a Christian perspective. And this is the kind of theme to which we'll be returning again and again. So again, why begin this kind of conversation where we do, which is to say with what we call arena rock, the arena rock of the mid-1970s. And here we do have to dabble in history just very briefly. Many of you will have a pretty clear sense of how rock music has unfolded. Sometime along about 1955, we get rock and roll in the form of Little Richard's and Elvis Presley's and Buddy Holly's music making. Rock and roll essentially dies out by about 1959. Many people are convinced that it was a sort of flash in the pan. The Beatles and the Rolling Stones and other bands kind of bring it back, selling America's pop music back to itself about 4 years later in 1963, 64. Suddenly, rock and roll seems to be back in this very powerful way. So rock develops from there. By the end of the 60s, we're dealing with progressive rock, the emergence of progressive rock. And rock has become more and more complicated. By the early 70s, progressive rock has really taken hold. This is an important part of our story. Progressive rock is what happens when rock artists decide to take themselves seriously as artists. When you decide, I'm not just here recording 1 minute and 50 second, 2 minute and 15 second songs with three verses, two choruses, and a bridge. I'm not just going to be doing this formula over and over again. We're going to create great art out of this. Now, we're going to whip through this history fast, but essentially, here's how it looks. Art music emerges as a kind of function of rock music. In 1965, the Beatles give a concert in Shea Stadium, which shows that it is possible for an extremely popular band to fill an entire stadium, an entire sports arena, with fans. Over the next couple of years, the technology advances. By 1969, we have events like 500,000 people gathering in the environs of Woodstock for an enormous outdoor music concert. The performance the Rolling Stones gave a short time later at the Altamont Speedway. We get a series of mammoth public musical events, outdoor events. By the early 70s, progressive rock rock with artistic aspirations, has risen to the occasion, has risen to the point that it seems to be doing something. Rock seems to be so serious and so artistically weighty that it starts to feel as though rock belongs in arenas, that rock is just that big, just that important. And Yes, and Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and other bands are recording songs that are 20 minutes long. And yes, this feels sort of mammoth and outsized. It feels as though it belongs in arenas, in these kind of venues that were just getting opened up in the 60s. Where we take up our story is after that great flash of progressive rock. After Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and Yes, and other bands' star had set, in the mid-70s, by 1974, 75, the public seemed to have lost interest in progressive rock as a project. Yet, we had all these commercial mechanisms in place where the public might not want progressive rock anymore, but they're still in the habit of coming to arenas to hear rock. They're still in the habit of gathering around the 15,000 other kids to hear rock music performances. And what it became clear needed to happen was that somebody had to hatch a way of recording songs, creating rock songs that behaved essentially like good old-fashioned rock songs, 4 minutes long, say, 3.5 minutes long. We want to get back to basics. We want to get away from all that, the excesses of progressive rock and get back to sort of good old-fashioned rock values. And there was a strong nostalgia here, but these had to be 4 minute songs that seemed very, very important, that seemed somehow to belong in arenas, that seemed to demand spaces this big to say the enormous things that needed to be said. And that's why we're getting on the boat here, because it is curious how often, well, not metaphorically, getting on the boat, because it's curious how often those ways that these arena rock artists had of trying to write meaning, write significance into their music, to make it seem like it was worthy of filling an arena, so big was the message. It's curious how often these rock artists hit on strategies that resemble very closely the strategies of the Christian message, of the Christian faith, which is to say, we have to gather these kids in the arenas and peddle very significant stories about the deepest issues of the human experience. Can we live in a state of hope in the face of despair? Can we expect to survive the kind of travails of this life and awaken to something better later on? What is music's role, finally, the music we're sitting and listening to? What is the role of that music in instilling in us a sense of hope, a sense of fundamental optimism in the face of all of the world's darkness? These are the kinds of issues that arena rock artists put before us again and again. So it's with a couple of these rock artists that I want to begin. There are three songs advertised in the blurb on the kiosk about this session. I'm pretty sure we're only getting to two of them. One by Bruce Springsteen, one by Boston. Aerosmith will just have to wait. You'll just have to take up Aerosmith on your own time. But we're going to begin with Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. At this point, I'm going to hand out a lyric sheet. It has on one side Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. On the second side, the second song we'll be taking on this evening, Boston's More Than a Feeling. I would ask you to spread these out. I think I have enough that probably two people per sheet will work fine. If you happen to be alone on a row, that's fine. Just take one and make use of it. But share if you are able. I think we'll probably have enough to go around.
I can go make more.
And Michael's already on the case if you haven't any of them. What's your sense, Don? Could we use more, do you think? Or 24 making their way around? I think we'll make it work. Okay. Let's go with it. It's 1975. We're talking about Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band's Born to Run album. Perhaps the greatest album ever recorded by this band that had been putting out, that would be putting albums out steadily through the 1970s and beyond. Bruce Springsteen, for those of you who are not familiar with him and his career, comes from a New Jersey scene. He is one of these people who seemed, in some sort of bizarre way, to have his finger in the most profound way imaginable on the pulse of the American working class experience. That there were things that he achieved in terms of encapsulating what it felt like to struggle in America, to be a person not able to sort of live out the dreams that he or she, generally he, wanted to live out in the United States. And this is one of his masterpieces, Born to Run, when it comes to the basic concerns that in a certain sense propelled his entire career, before and since, the question of what we do in the face of the kind of grinding despair of a working class existence, or the grinding challenges of a working class existence. And obviously not all working class existences nor worthy of despair, but he wants to confront those situations that are, to confront the experience of young people in particular, growing up in towns that give them no cause for hope, towns that don't seem to offer them anything to be optimistic about where their own futures are concerned. I just want to listen to the first two verses of this song. To let the cat out of the bag a bit, we get two verses and then what we'll call a bridge, a kind of central section that isn't a verse. It's new musical material, new lyrical material. Then we'll get a kind of instrumental stretch and then a final verse. And what I want to do now is listen to the first two verses of this song. And I want to have you ponder a couple of things. To begin with, what is the music doing in this song? If this song happened, for example, to be in Czech or some other language that most of us didn't know, would you still have any inkling of what this song was about? And how would you know if you couldn't understand the words at all? What would the music be communicating to you if the words weren't there to do communicating? Or to put the matter in somewhat less extreme terms, just what does the music have to do with the words? What does the music seem to be, how does the music seem to be helping? Secondly, in the second verse, Wendy shows up. Who is Wendy? What's her significance? What can we do with this? We'll come back to it. And in very general senses, what does this song in its first two verses, what is feared? What is being feared in this song? And what is being hoped for in this song? And again, we'll give it two verses. We'll see what we can do. So focus on those two things. Who's Wendy? What's the fear all about? What's the hope all about? And what is the music doing there? Let's give it a listen. Is the volume about right? I ordinarily talk about this stuff to a bunch of 18-year-olds who want it loud. Very good. Okay, we'll leave it there. Okay, what about it? To begin with, what is the music doing here? What is the music communicating that helps out what the words are doing? What do you think? Yeah, I'll tell you what, let's come back to that. First, the easy ones. What's being feared? What's being hoped for? How can we sort of configure those issues? What is this fellow afraid of?
Being trapped.
Okay. Other thoughts, other ways of coming at it?
Being irrelevant.
how do you mean? And how do, I mean, how do you know?
Seems to be aspiring for something, something more than what he sees around him.
Good.
I think it's more stuck.
Okay. Okay. Other ways of coming at this?
More violent and desperate than that. Soul's been ripped out.
Yeah. It's a death trap. It's a suicide rap. This town rips the bones from your back. I mean, this is pretty strong stuff. Yeah. There's, yes, stuck is a good word for it.
Spineless, then.
Spineless, yeah. Being spineless. Good, of somehow being emasculated, of being reduced, caged. And it isn't just a matter of not being able to exercise your will, it's a matter of having your will ripped out of you, of being deprived of your will, if you submit to this for too long. And what can we say about what's being hoped for? I mean, what is the promise here? Or can, anything we can articulate?
What's love?
Okay, love. What do we learn about love? Is there anything in particular we can...
I think he doesn't want to be alone.
Okay.
He wants good. Someone to love.
Good.
With him.
Great.
It's a very wild love here.
Yeah.
It's tied up with cars and velvet rims.
That's right. No, that's right. Yes. I mean,
it's kind of a desperate attempt to feel something.
Good. Yeah, I mean, that is that we want love, we want to feel something.
Liberation.
And we want liberation. Good. And it isn't totally clear, at least at this point, how those things are ever going to be obtained. I mean, Wendy doesn't have a job offer in some other city or something like that. I mean, it's not like Wendy really knows the way out. But somehow getting in contact with Wendy in this way is this kind of sight for hope. That at least if he can get this woman in the car or on a motorcycle, you know, something good can happen. There will be some reason for optimism.
This reminds me of the final scene from the movie The Graduate.
Great. Yeah. Do you want to remind us what goes on there?
Well, they escape.
Right.
Dustin Hoffman gets her not to marry that foreign guy.
That's right.
And they get on the bus and they take off.
Yeah.
And then they look at each other like, oh, now what?
Absolutely. And it is this thing. They're sort of giddy, smiling in this sort of crazy way, and then they look at each other, and it all sort of sobers up for this terrible moment, and then they kind of try to smile again, but you're not sure if the smile is still legit or not.
That line, "Will you walk with me out on the wire?"
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like a longing for adventure, excitement.
Great.
You know,
good. Yeah, it is, you know, you
basic
want
to that age.
Feel, and there is this sense of wildness about it. I want to continue having this taste for wildness. I want to continue going for it. Okay.
There's kind of a sense that the dream is real. We can live this dream.
Yeah. Terrific.
And escape.
Terrific. And it's interesting how easy it is to describe this dream in purely negative terms, that somehow this dream is whatever this town is not. And I'm not quite sure what it is. I'm still learning about the nature of love. I'm still sort of finding out if love is wild and all that. It's not totally clear where he wants to get, but he knows what he wants to get away from. And so far, the dream is this kind of negative space somehow. Other thoughts about Wendy? Why is her name Wendy?
Because of the Beach Boys.
Because of the Beach Boys. Well, perhaps. Yeah, and the Association has their song about Wendy. Other
Mother of the Lost Boys.
Yeah, why the heck not? Yeah. And in a certain sense, what's special about Peter Pan? Well, several things are special about Peter Pan. He can fly, for goodness sake. And so if indeed this guy is saying, I'm going to set myself up against this foil of Wendy, Peter Pan's Wendy, why am I doing that? Well, Peter Pan can fly. Peter Pan can be detached from his shadow. He can leave that shadow... My wife is here, and she's always embarrassed for me at moments like this. I get choked up over this song. It's an amazing song. He can leave his shadow, and he doesn't have to get old. He doesn't have to face adulthood. Yes, I think it's that Wendy. I think it's safe to say this is why it's Wendy and not Linda or Scooter or anybody else. That you know, this is a very useful Wendy as a jumping-off point. Let's hear what happens. Let's hear if he ever gets there. I'm going to go ahead and let the cat out of the bag a bit. Many of you know this song by heart and don't need me to tell you this. Many of you will work your way ahead already. Bruce Springsteen grew in the early 70s out of the grand sort of Bob Dylan tradition that dwelled in the certainty that rock lyrics could in fact be poetry, that they really could be good, that you could do important poetic stuff with rock lyrics. And I think that Bruce Springsteen does as he makes his way into this bridge beyond the palace. Hemi-powered drones scream down the boulevard. The girls comb their hair in rearview mirrors, and the boys try to look so hard. The amusement park rises bold and stark. Kids are huddled on the beach in the mist. I want to die with you, Wendy, on the street tonight, in an everlasting kiss. This really is powerful stuff. And again, we seem to be sort of out of the specific motorcycle, out of the car, sort of surveying this all, surveying the entire world inhabited by our protagonist. And we're given this series of epigrams, this series of images about kids who are sort of caught there between childhood and adulthood. They're children who want to be adults, children who can almost pull it off, almost feel like adults. And where do we find them? We find them in this borderland between the land and the ocean, between the known and this vast unknown. And in the graduate, you know, when we reach the high point of the transgressive experience, it's in this convertible with rain falling all over them, in which, Dustin Hoffman, Benjamin, and Elaine, Mrs. Robinson have their sort of final big blowout. And it's raining outside. It's always raining where sexual transgression is concerned. Water is a marker of sort of sexual knowing, of sexual transgression in many contexts, of that sort of the mystery of sexual awakening. That's what water does in so many literary contexts. And here we have these kids sort of huddled on the beach, looking at the water. Everything is mysterious. Everything is shrouded in mist. The tools of childhood, the amusement park, this seems to be in disuse, is, you know, at their backs. Powerful stuff. At that point, the song ends, or the song appears to end. That if you didn't know any better, you would think that what happens after the big long instrumental breakdown that comes next, the big long instrumental stretch after this bridge, you might well think that the song is ending. We get this sort of rising series of meditations on a particular motive, and finally the band all joins together to run through every note on the piano scale. It's not the happiest ending in the world, but I guess that's how it goes. And it's as though the whole band has just kind of fallen exhausted before. We've tried everything. We've tried every note. We've done all we can, and here we are just sort of collapsed on the floor, and everything stops. And those of you who know the song cannot forget what happens next. That somewhere from the din, we hear Bruce Springsteen counting them back to life. 1, 2, 3, 4. And they kick into a final verse. And with this final verse, the highway's jam of broken heroes, it's a different verse. Bruce Springsteen has been transformed. In the simplest terms, the verse is taken up, most of the opening stretch of the verse, taken up the better part of an octave. He began down here. That's where he begins. In this last verse, he is no longer down here. He's way up here. Takes the entire opening of this verse an octave too high. So it's not just that he has called the band back to life. It's not just rebirth. It is transfiguration that has taken place. The verse is transformed into, you know, an octave higher, into a sort of transcendent version of itself. And I guess what I invite you to ponder as we listen through this is, word-wise, what has been accomplished? Have they figured it out? Have Wendy and he sort of come up with a plan? Well, okay, let's go to Boston. You can start working in a cafe and do this and that. Well, no, they haven't figured anything out. And as far as the words are concerned, we haven't really got anywhere. We haven't figured out why we should hope. You know, someday, girl, I don't know when, we're going to get to that place where we really want to go. But they have no idea where that is. They have no idea how they're going to get there. The words themselves are hopeless, yet the music describes this path of death and rebirth, of death and transcendence, that the words don't seem to have access to. Let's give it a listen. We're starting after the second verse, building our way into the bridge here. Said about everything I want to say about the song. What about you all? What do you get out of this? Uh-oh. Soon enough.
Did you grow up in Jersey?
No. But I'm still one of these. Again, those of you who grew up in Jersey, those of you who are down with Bruce, you'll understand how this works. That if you're backstage with AC/DC, for example, of the band, and you walk out the stage door with them, and there's a guy in the alley who pulls out a gun and sticks him up, you dive behind the dumpster and get away. If you're walking out of that door with Bruce Springsteen and somebody sticks you up, you take the bullet. You die in front of Bruce. There's this kind of worship that Bruce Springsteen inspires, that there's just this kind of insight that he seems to embody in this just kind of truthfulness that seems to lodge in him in this kind of strange, imminent way.
Well,
he,
what impresses me is what did change? I mean, I'm thinking, who had the hot cars when I went to high school as a greaser? That didn't really have a future.
Yeah.
They're the ones with the chrome. They're the ones that are cruising. They're wondering if they're going anywhere. And that's what I hear in this first verse or two.
Yeah.
And somehow, they're still running at the end, but it's got a different feeling to it. What has caused the transformation in that worldview for the author here? The girl has something to do with it, obviously. Mm-hmm. But it strikes to me, as you said, nothing really seems to have changed,
yeah.
But what they're about seems to be affirmed.
Yeah.
That's part of the mystery of the song. I listen to the music, not to the lyrics as much, honestly. Right.
I never came to that. What, Peter, I'm going to hunt down all this, but what about the music? What do you, when you say you listen to the music, what are you listening to? What do you mean listening to the music?
Well, it really is, it's glass packs, it's rumbling. They're cruising, and that's what I'm thinking of, going from the Dog and Suds over to McDonald's and around.
Yeah.
I went to, when I was in college, so this is a podcast.
run around in fast cars, and he's kind of an okay guy.
He puts on 3-hour concerts, just like a working guy.
Nobody does that. He does. I'm Simon Frith, one of the, well, probably the greatest pop music scholar who's ever, put pen to paper. Works partly as a sociologist, academic sociologist, partly as a journalist, and so he reviews a lot of concerts. He has dedicated an entire article to the way Bruce Springsteen dresses. That when other people dress in jeans and flannel or whatever, they're putting on some kind of show. They're dressing that way in a calculated way. No, Bruce Springsteen is wearing those clothes for real. These are his working clothes because he gets out there and puts on 3-4-hour concerts. And this is absolutely right. That everybody else in the business, they have warm-up bands who come out and play a set, 45 minutes. Then, you know, the main act will come out and play for an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and a half, and that's your show. Bruce Springsteen, they don't fiddle around with warm-up bands. They take the stage, they play for 3.5 hours, that's the show. I mean, it's amazing the way the energy this guy brings night after night. There's this kind of authenticity about everything down the way for us.
You know, in connection with the long concerts, just the music here is pushing things so far to an edge that it's like that what you described, that moment where it seems to just be collapsing into a state of chaos.
Yeah.
It's just so over the top.
Yeah.
It can't go any farther. And the concerts have that same kind of energy.
Yeah.
There's nothing held back.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. I just want to say, by the way, just from perspective, I'm someone who's never really given Springsteen much of a chance, but this is interesting to me because it seems maybe in the last verse that he's moving beyond desperation, kind of embracing the journey, not needing to know the result, and that's kind of letting him bypass some of the desperation.
There's kind of the sense that the transcendent life is available to the common guy. And I know he punctuates many of his concerts with the repeated question, is there anybody really alive out there? And they'll say this time and again, and really kind of pulling people into a transcendent mode of thinking.
Yep, the one time I saw him, 1986, I was in the balcony. I was probably 100 yards from that stage, a long way away, but still, he was just right there. He was talking to me.
What are you doing without the words in that last verse? There's sort of a peace and a serenity that then when you look at that, he is accepting that this is what his life is going to be.
Yeah.
It all comes together.
Yeah. And perhaps the goal is some kind of self-knowledge. Who knows? That one thing that may have changed is nothing about the situation's changed, but now he's sort of matured into the knowledge of what he's got.
You know, how do your 18-year-olds see it?
They've never heard of Bruce Springsteen. Maybe. I don't know. That's a great question. And especially in light of the fact that so much of the music that they grew up with and so much of the music they heard. I mean, when we deal with 18-year-olds, we are dealing with people born on that great divide, that some of you will be more sort of attentive to than others in the progress of your daily lives, but the divide that was the 1991 release of Nirvana's, first big sort of breakthrough studio album, Nevermind. Nirvana, with the onset of grunge, with the onset of alternative rock, and sort of taking the limelight, everything about the rock scene changed. I believe it's the most influential album of the last 30 years. And since then, in a certain sense, despair has been kind of the order of the day. I mean, so much of this music is so despairing, and I deeply admire much of it. I mean, I love Nirvana myself, and I love many of the people who came afterwards. But despair has become so readily accessible that this is, in a certain sense, this music is revelatory to them. There was a point in rock history when the order of the day was optimism. I mean, that music was optimistic, and that music was about the reclamation of hope. Because that, I don't think, is what music is about today. I'm not sure, and I don't want to badmouth modern music, because again, I love a lot of it. I mean, I don't think there's ever been a point when more talented people have been out there peddling their wares in the pop music business. We're in a very exciting time right now. But the landscape has changed, such that I'm not sure how seriously you could be taken if you came out today just trying to sell hope, just trying to sell optimism. It's a much harder sell these days. And I don't know what they make of Bruce Springsteen. And this, you've taken me down a path I didn't want to go down. I don't. I mean, it's a fascinating question, just where kids are these days.
He had asked earlier for us to listen carefully to the music, and I've always found it curious. You've got the hard driving, the guitar, that saxophone, and then there's a chime or something in there.
I mean, it's a very sort of carefully wrought texture, and the chime, if I'm thinking of the same thing you're thinking about, it's this thing that sort of follows this, I mean, the whole, you know, glass pack mufflers are grinding along there. And we have this sort of soaring thing that comes back, this ritornello, this thing that sort of pursues us through the song, ba 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 ba. And I think it's that, even in the last verse, even as he sings, it's the return of that little ritornello, ba 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 ba, with this little chime. That, oh my gosh, it's still alive. This little sort of flower that we've been, you know, lovingly tending to through the whole song, it's still there, reborn. I know exactly what you mean. That it's, there's this overabundance about the whole texture. There's everything about this song is above and beyond the call of duty. Just like him in concert, there's just too much there. There's more there than really must be to get the point across. But I know exactly.
That scaled down, it sounded like a symphony or something. I mean, it sounds really formal.
Yep. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. If we think about when the Beatles are recording A Day in the Life, and basically you have a song that John Lennon wrote, a song that Paul McCartney wrote, and so you stick two, you know, chunks of the John Lennon song around the Paul McCartney song. Meanwhile, you bring 40 members of the London Philharmonic into the studio, the studio, and say, look, I don't care what you play, but begin on this note, end on this note, and that's our transition. And that's what they do, is they have this, or they start down there and end up there. But it's the same kind of chaos about it or something, and the same kind of, you know, symphonic grandeur that's accomplished in A Day in the Life. I think you're absolutely right.
Maybe this is a tangent, but the music is so grandiose, so yearning, so driving. I've never listened to the words before this. I love this song in my life. I heard it when I was a teen. I've never heard this song. Isn't this part of his problem? I mean, born in the USA, a deeply cynical song, but used for political campaigns.
Yeah. And so the problem you're saying is people just aren't listening to the words.
Well, maybe it's a matter of craftsmanship.
Yeah.
I mean, this music is just so over.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right that it's so easy to sort of float past the words, given the other gratifications that are just lying there on the surface. And this is a great question. And a question that, especially with songs that are even, that are charged with more sort of directly meaningful things than this, political music. There are plenty of songs out there today that have very powerful political messages that want to be protest songs, protesting wars, protesting certain administrations, whatever. They want to be protest songs. But it really does kind of feel as though we've lost that category, that now all songs dwell on the condition you're describing, of the music is so overwhelming. Who really cares? Who really cares if we're talking about the situation in Nicaragua or whatever?
It's hard to understand this music lyrics sometimes.
It sure is.
I don't remember. In his albums, did he print the lyrics?
That's a great question. Yes, I think. I seem to recall that he does. And I do own many of these.
Spent a lot of time with the Beatles or others going, and it really is helpful to have.
Yeah.
In rock music, when you can't always hear the answer.
This is a wonderful.
Like listening to Nebraska, though, which is so scaled down, very dark. You can understand everything he says.
Right.
It's a dark album.
Yeah, it sure is.
It's actually my favorite.
This acoustic album that he recorded, he claims, is sort of demos for an E Street Band album, but at some point he woke up and said, well, heck, there's the album. I mean, just these little me and the acoustic guitar laying these tracks down. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, the LP of Going to Run was a fold-out LP, and the lyrics are printed inside. And the cover is one of the most iconic covers in rock and roll history, because it has an image of Bruce on the front side and leaning against Clarence Clemons, the saxophone player, who's black.
Yeah.
And it's just this incredibly powerful image of the two of them in basically in harmony together. This is 1975 when that came out. And so that's the image that you get when you open it up and the lyrics again.
Yeah.
We saw him in 75 right after the album came out.
that he put
on. It was revelatory.
At Paramount in Seattle.
Oh my God.
Which is the small theater. I mean, we were so close.
Yeah. That's amazing. Well, I should have let you know we were on the show for the last 10 times. I'm glad you remember the album cover better than I do. I've got it at home with my brother's car. The way my life runs, I don't think I've had the LP out for the whole time. We should press on. This is wonderful. I cannot tell a lie. I've taught this song many times in many contexts, but every time that I do, I'm taught things about it, and you all have brought a lot to this song. Thank you for what you've contributed. In the 14 minutes we have left, I want to talk about Boston's More Than a Feeling. Flip that sheet over. Happily, More Than a Feeling is a masterpiece in its way, but I think a more modest way than Springsteen's Born to Run is. This is the first track on the first album that Boston put forth. And the sound of the band really was stunning in purely technical terms. That is just the depth of the production, the layering of the guitar tracks, and all that. It really was a kind of dazzling sound. And the blurb on the back of the album, the sort of pitch for the album on the back of the LP when it came out, has a lot to do with Tom, with the sort of lead singer, songwriter, guitar player's own sort of technical prowess, that he has a degree from MIT and electrical engineering or something, I can't remember what, and that he is really in charge of all this technology and he's got it under control. And this is much that the album tries, or the back of the album tries to reassure us about. This song is interesting in that it taps into a vein that we hear many different places at this particular moment in rock history, which is a particular kind of inflection of the issues we've been talking about where Bruce Springsteen is concerned. If you are putting on a show in an arena, and if your purpose is to make it seem as though the music you're there peddling is extremely important somehow, that you have extremely weighty things to say, one thing you can do is do what Bruce Springsteen does, just talk about weighty things. I mean, actually tell weighty stories and deliver a giant sound, as Bruce Springsteen does. But another thing you can do, which is the option that Boston opts for, is not exactly to talk about weighty things, but to talk about music being weighty. That is, to actually sort of sell the stuff, to say, look how important this music is. Look how significant this music is in our lives, to write songs about songs. And this is one important way that many artists of the time sort of hit on to try to make this music feel significant, is to write songs about how significant they are. And so in this case, I looked out this morning and the sun was gone. Turned on some music to start my day, then I lost myself in a familiar song. I closed my eyes and I slipped away. It's more than a feeling when I hear that old song they used to play, and I begin dreaming till I see Marianne walk away. I see my Marianne walking away. And this is one of those songs that I think it isn't that we don't understand the lyrics, but those of us who have been listening to this song forever know the lyrics so well that we could no better describe them than we could describe the pattern of a wallpaper in our bedrooms or something. We've been looking at it forever, but just have never really paid much attention. And somehow these words, it's easy to listen to this song a million times and not know what it is obviously about, which is being delivered from a sort of prosaic, tragic world by music into some kind of better place. Let's give the first two verses a listen. In this case, we have two verses, then we get a kind of guitar solo, and then we get another verse and chorus. That's what we get, verse, chorus, guitar solo, and then a verse, chorus, but again, a verse and chorus at the end in which everything has been transformed in some magical way. Let's listen to the first half, the first two verse chorus pairs. Here we go. So already there's technology at work, this fade in.
Thank you.
the solo for the next chunk. I'll ask the same kind of questions I asked about Springsteen. First off, being confronted, what's being hoped for, what are these words about? And it isn't Springsteen. We're not dealing with sort of masterful poetry here, I don't think, but what, anything we can say about it?
Loss.
Okay, loss of what exactly? Right, in the simple term of Mary Ann.
Another girl gone.
That's right. That's right.
Bites the dust.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's curious. In the same way that Wendy seems to kind of come in and symbolize something for Springsteen, we can't be sure what, but isn't that convenient? On the second verse, this sort of femme fatale or whatever.
It's the loss of Louie Louie, too.
The loss of Louie Louie.
Because
oh, yeah.
What, you know, what I kind of hear that when they go fading into the song and the volume comes up and they get into those guitar riffs are really basic. Like Wild Thing or Louie Louie, it's an old time song that they're echoing.
Yep.
And that's he's going back in time when things were really simple.
Look at this guy go. Yes. Yes. A quick show of hands. How many of you actually know Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit? Is this a song with which we're okay? Then I'm not going to get into this. But yes, what we find in this chorus, as we the verses sort of, we're getting ahead of ourselves. The verses are acoustic guitar driven, that we're given this sort of image of this kind of intimate encounter with an acoustic guitar playing guy, sort of telling this sad tale about his sadness, and yes, then we sort of move through this kind of passage of some pre-chorus into the chorus, and when the chorus arrives, it is with this repetitious four chord cycle, and all the heads start to bop, and we really start to rise. So it goes. This is exactly how Smells Like Teen Spirit is. That Nirvana song, too. But Peter is absolutely right. I'm going to give him money after this. I've been lecturing on the song forever. I've never had this thought. He's absolutely right. That what is being sort of culled out here in this sort of four-bar pattern, which works downbeat, offbeat, downbeat, offbeat. That's how the four chords are set up. Thing, that good old rock and roll. This is what's being recalled and what finally sort of makes its way overwhelmingly into the foreground with these grinding electric guitars with every chorus. Other thoughts? Well done.
You quite hear
that. But there's this kind of nostalgia about the whole thing. Now, what is magical and what is finally so simple that it washes by with this terrific power, but something much more sort of crystalline in its simplicity than anything Bruce Springsteen serves up, is what goes on as the song unfolds. We have, as it were, two musical characters, two musical realms that signify two kind of psychological realms in our guy. We have the opening sort of acoustic guitar stuff, that nice gentle thing that is very difficult to capture on the piano. Kind of thing. This nice acoustic guitar riff that's the second song everybody learns on the acoustic guitar after Stairway to Heaven. Everybody knows how to play this, or everybody in my generation did. And then we break into that grinding sort of other thing, which is the chorus, which is the song that is carrying this guy out of his sort of world weariness, that's carrying him away from all that tragedy of the world. And as we recall, every chorus ends the same way. When I see Marianne walk away. And when he sees Marianne walk away, we hit this poignant chord. Let's see. Till I see Marianne walk away. See my Marianne walking away. And suddenly everything is sad. And as soon as Marianne walks away, well, she's the symbol of everything. We don't know who Marianne is. We know nothing about her. All she has to do in this song is leave. That's what the song is about, loss. And this is all we have to know about his world, about the world of those verses. It is a world of loss, a world of tragedy. What happens in the last verse is he goes back into that world of loss. He has to re-inhabit it. When I'm tired and I'm thinking cold, I hide in my music. forget the day, and I dream of a girl I used to know. I close my eyes, and she slipped away. And what we'll notice here, this magic moment, this is the part when we're supposed to sort of enter the chorus, but we don't. He's supposed to go, close my eyes and she slipped away. That's what we're supposed to get, but we don't. We sort of continue, you'll hear it, we continue with the chord progression of the verses. The band enters, but the band sort of embraces the chord progression of the verses. She doesn't slip away, she does, the way that she does. At the end of all the other verses, the band sort of carries him forward. And he finds himself singing his way up into the stratosphere. And at this point, the real magic of the song happens. An acoustic or an electric guitar enters. Our lead guitar enters on this pitch up here where he is singing up in the stratosphere. And at the moment his voice reaches that pitch, the electric guitar has reached it with him. And a guitar solo unfolds from there. But for one magic instant, it isn't clear what's his voice and what's the guitar. And it really is as though the guitar sort of bears his voice aloft. Mm-hmm. And the guitar bears his voice away. As the song winds down, you will hear at the end of the last chorus, he sees Marianne walk away, the band couldn't care less. The band wins. The band just keeps on grinding it out with the four-chord chorus idea. And again, he faces the reality of his sadness. He faces the loss of Marianne, but the music has got him now. The music has him in its embrace, and it's all going to be okay. If it's all going to be okay, if I can find the remote. Here we go. Making our way into the first guitar solo, listen as we go through this, for the way in which the final verse, the band sort of carries on, finally his stratospheric voice is turned into a guitar through some kind of magical alchemy as the guitar carries his voice aloft. And finally the band takes him away. Closing thoughts.
Well, it strikes me there's a similarity between these two songs. I mean, the ending of this one in particular, there's so much sadness lyrically and a sense of slipping away. And you expect that sort of intimacy, but instead, what you get is a kind of triumph.
Yeah.
And the ending of Born to Run is that refrain, of course, but tramps like us, baby, we're born to run, which is pretty desperate, but musically,
yeah.
You know, and in concert, of course, everybody, you get 15,000 people shouting, tramps like us, those three heavy beats,
yeah.
And both of these take that loss and turn it into triumph musically.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I don't think there's a better way to encapsulate my mission tonight. I think it's exactly what we're after. That music makes these promises, that music achieves these things, achieves this transcendence in ways that the prosaic world of words never can. On that happy note, let's wrap things up. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.